This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, once again broadcasting on this podcast and also broadcasting through the good auspices of civic media. Delighted and honored once again that you've chosen to spend some time in discovery with me and exploration with me of some of those major issues having to do with the rule of law, the aspiration of justice, and the operation of government in a what is undeniably a very challenging time in our nation's history. This is the fourth and the final of our series of broadcasts and podcasts in which we're talking specifically about the term of the United States Supreme Court just completed, the 2025-2026 term. With our upcoming broadcasts, we're going to be returning to our normal, our more traditional practice of reviewing some of the major rule of law news every single week, commenting on that, reporting on that, giving you some insights, some perspective, so that you can make some judgment calls, some decisions of your own about how we are to understand and interpret those important things going on in our lives. But this session, again, going to do a little bit of summarizing of what we've talked about before, and then spending a fair amount of time talking once again about elections, and especially relevant to this time period here in Wisconsin and throughout the nation when we are once again returning to the polls. So let's begin by talking once again about the United States Supreme Court. A number of you have from time to time asked me not only about recent statistics, but about the past. And I have previously noted, for example, in this term, that the Supreme Court has heard oral arguments of well in excess of 60 cases, issued opinions in about 65, 66 of those, and provided you with other information about the nature of those cases. Let me do a bit of history in this particular area and note, for example, that if you go back about 5 years or so, it has been on the average about 60 times that the Supreme Court has in a particular term entertained oral argument. And so this term, the 2025-2026 term, pretty much on track for that same amount of cases. It is also relevant to note that during the course of the past 5 years, there have been more than a few almost completely split decisions by our United States Supreme Court. And by that, I mean decisions that come in at the 5-4 voting level. And since 2021, there have been just under 8 of those kinds of cases every single term. Every single term of the past 5 years, there have been somewhere between 7.5 or 7.6 cases like that where the Supreme Court has split right down the middle. Of course, we've spent a lot of time talking on this podcast, this broadcast, about the fact that we've got a lot of decisions that have split right down partisan lines to 6-3 divide, and more than a few that have gone 7-2, and a very few that have been unanimous in nature. But it's been the average, somewhere between 7 and 8 of those 5-4 decisions in the past 5 years or so. And again, the number of decisions issued has been right around 63. This term, they're just a little bit in excess of that. Another statistic, which I find interesting, I suspect you will too, since we spend a lot of time talking about who are the authors of these opinions, both for majority and also for the dissenting opinions, did some research and did some examination of who among the justices, who's written the most majority opinions. Let me give you some of those statistics for this term, and then also go back 4 or 5 terms to give you a feel for what those authors look like and who they are. This term, the 2025-2026 term, there have been a grand total of 7 opinions issued by each of the justices Alito, Gorsuch, and Barrett. That is 7 each, in which they have been the principal authors of the majority opinion. 7 each for Alito, Gorsuch, and Barrett. In the last term, 2024-2025, Thomas, Kavanaugh, and Barrett have all weighed in also at 7 cases, 7 opinions each over the course of that singular term. During the previous term, an interesting change in that seeming tradition, that seeming trend, between 2023 and 2024, Elena Kagan, at the top of the list, issuing 8 opinions on behalf of the majority, and she stands alone at that level. And then you go back a previous term, which is 2022 to 2023, and there again we return to the so-called conservatives on the bench, where Justices Thomas and Kavanaugh each authored 7 majority opinions, And then prior to that, the 2021-2022 term, going back a full 5 years, it was Chief Justice Roberts and former Associate Justice Breyer. Each of them issued 8 opinions on behalf of the majority in the Supreme Court. Some interesting statistics related to the history of the court, again, pretty much on track in this particular term for those same numbers. As we've commented before, the Supreme Court in this period of time is not out of business. They continue to do some important things. We'll talk about one of those events in the news in just a few moments. But they also continue to populate the number of cases that they're going to be hearing in the coming year. That is the 2026-2027 term. And last week, I reported that they had populated their docket with about 20 cases. It's jumped a little bit. It has jumped to about 25 cases now, and that has included, again, one or two more in which the Supreme Court, again, going to be taking up additional cases, one of those having to do with an Eighth Amendment case involving excessive fines. We talked in previous broadcasts about their Eighth Amendment jurisprudence, and in particular, this notion of cruel and unusual punishment prohibited by the Eighth Amendment, and focused in particular upon the death penalty. Another part of that Eighth Amendment, of course, prohibits excessive fines being imposed by the government, especially by the courts. And the Supreme Court, interestingly, has added to its docket for the coming term one of those 25 cases involves what is an excessive fine? What does that mean? So that is going to be on the docket of the Supreme Court in the coming term. We plainly, as we continue to broadcast here on Civic Media, will talk a lot about those cases, not only those that are populating the next term, but as they continue with their oral arguments, beginning again in October, November, December, January of next year, we'll comment on those as well. We'll see what that docket looks like as it comes together in the following week. Go to the Supreme Court again on this emergency application docket and to seek a review, immediate review, by the Supreme Court, maintaining that urgently the Supreme Court has got to overturn, reverse what the lower courts have done, and tell those lower courts that they have been wrong. And so the Solicitor General writing that what the lower courts have done is indefensible, will impose serious irreparable harm on the federal government, and will affect elections in a way that's contrary to what at least the administration thinks those elections should be all about. That application now pending before the Supreme Court. The justice responsible for the First Circuit, his name is Sam Alito, has directed that the parties file briefs on this by this coming Monday, which of course is the third of the new month. And presumably sometime after that, the Supreme Court will determine whether or not they're going to take this emergency application and what they're going to do with it. If they do, in fact, decide to review it, will they once again afford the president the authority to do this in a situation where the Constitution is quite clear? Or will they say, no, we're not going to permit the president to engage in this extra responsibility outside of his presidential authorities in a way that would undermine the Constitution and the ways in which we think about the administration of our voting throughout the nation? And so that happened just this past week as well. And that leads necessarily then to a discussion of, once again, the voting decisions of the United States Supreme Court. There have been 4 of them altogether, and we can make at least somewhat shorter shrift of at least 2, maybe 3 of them in particular. We know that in the area of mail-in ballots, the Supreme Court issued 2 opinions, one coming out of the Seventh Circuit, in particular telling a congressman there and telling all of us that if you've got objections to the way that the states are administering voting and handling the cases in their particular states, you can, in fact, go into federal courts. And they found in particular in this case involving Congressman Bost from Southern Illinois that he has the right, even though he won the election, to contest something about the Illinois process. That is that Illinois continues to count ballots even after Election Day. They said that he's got the right to contest that. And that received that order, that decision by the Supreme Court, received favorable reviews across the board, even by people who would not otherwise be allied with someone like Congressman Bost. Why? Because the case itself simply reaffirms this notion that you can, in fact, go into the courts and seek redress of grievances through the courts for your challenges to processes in the courts. Didn't decide the case that the congressman was bringing. That was left to another case, and that is the matter coming out of Mississippi, in which the Supreme Court said that the grace period there, a five-day grace period in which the state allows local clerks to count ballots that are not received by election day, but sent in by voters, postmarked by voters on election day, those can be counted. And so we have those two sort of companion cases coming out of the United States Supreme Court. And then we have a major case also involving campaign financing, the court finding that some spending limits on political parties and candidates cannot stand. The question before the justices was whether or not the current financial limits on things called coordinated party expenditures violates the First Amendment. That is, whether or not political parties themselves can directly support candidates, or whether they've got to do it through what has been the tradition up to now of going through PACs. The lead up into the midterm elections and into the midterm elections in November is that the ruling coming out of the Supreme Court that is lifting the limits on the extent to which political parties can spend on advertising and other expenses. As we go into these elections, it's likely to help Republicans. And let me explain the way that that works. What the Supreme Court said is, by a 6-3 decision, divided once again along ideological lines, a major victory for the Republicans, one that will probably undercut some of the Democrats' financial advantage. The Supreme Court saying that it is a violation of the First Amendment to prohibit, for the most part, prohibiting political parties from being able to directly support candidates. Now, the reason why that's so important, and the reason why those spending limits on political parties have now been lifted, is that it has to do with a crucial area of what we think about in terms of voting today, and that's broadcast advertising time. Let me explain that. Federal law requires that broadcasters offer lower advertising rates to political candidates as individuals, but they're not required to do the same low rates for these so-called super PACs, which up to now have been the mechanism through which the political parties have been required to make payments in support of campaigns. In recent years, as we all well know, as reporting has been in this area, it's the Democratic candidates that have often raised more money than the Republicans, particularly most significantly through small dollar contributions online. The court's decision will effectively allow Republicans to send more money to candidates directly, likely allowing them to qualify for those same lower advertising rates. And that's the reason why, as a practical matter, this change in the rule, the lifting of the rules on these spending limits, is so important. The justices, and in particular Justice Kavanaugh, said that this treats all political parties equally. He goes on to say, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, all political parties and candidates going forward can compete equally under the same rules regarding coordinated expenditures and can structure their fundraising, spending, and political speech on a level playing field as they see fit within the law. And again, the reason why he says that is because it does, in fact, make the rules the same. It has a very different impact because of where money has traditionally come between the Republicans and the Democrats. And look for changes, therefore, in the advertising rates and as those are afforded to now political parties that are permitted to make these direct contributions. Needless to say, dissenters in that case, Elena Kagan, wrote that the ruling was a recipe for corruption, allowing, she said, donors to skirt contribution caps to candidates. She went on to say that with no limits on coordinated expenditures, the party can serve as the candidate's checking account. Elena Kagan went on to say that the upshot of the court's campaign finance decision was a legal regime increasingly unable to stop political corruption and thus preserve our institution's democratic legitimacy. Those three cases, again, the two of them having to do with mail-in ballots, important again in Wisconsin, even in this primary time, but also important to states around the country. Those two cases, this other case involving political contributions going to change the ways in which we understand campaigns in Wisconsin and throughout our nation? The big case, of course, that we have chatted about before, both in terms of oral arguments, made reference to it before, it is from my perspective, along with this other case involving Rebecca Slaughter and the positing of great authority in the president to terminate people inside independent agencies. This other matter, this second case unrelated to that, called Louisiana versus Kelly, equally important in terms of the future of America and the way that we think about voting in America in particular. Let's go back and think a little bit about the Voting Rights Act of 1965. It's the most important civil rights legislation in our nation's history, that proclaimed by people on all sides of the political aisle, passed by the Congress, a bipartisan passage signed by President Johnson August 5th of 1965. And then amended by the Congress, supported by the Congress over five times to expand the voting procedures for racial minorities and people of different non-English speaking languages. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act prohibits state and local governments from imposing restrictions on the rights of citizens to vote based on what? Based upon race, color, or language. And that's the key provision of the Voting Rights Act, is Section 2. There's also Section 4 and 5. Important to understand for the history of this, requiring pre-clearance by the Justice Department before changes could be implemented in places of historical discrimination. In other words, if you have for years, maybe decades before the Voting Rights Act of 1965, gotten a history of discrimination against people who, again, speak non-English languages or people of color, you are then on a list, and before you can change your voting rules and regulations, you have to get clearance or pre-clearance from the Department of Justice. That's Section 4 and 5. So what happens in the wake of that? Again, many cases enforcing Section 2, Section 4, and Section 5. And the reason I tell you all of that is not just because of the law school that we often are here on Amicus, a law review, but also because it's important to understand the very dramatic thing that happened just in recent weeks in this past term of the Supreme Court. Way back in 2013, in a case called Shelby County versus Holder, the High Court, the Supreme Court, held that that pre-clearance provision of Section 4 and Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act unconstitutional, basically tore that from the statute, saying that it's no longer consistent with contemporary understandings of where these places are, directed basically the Congress to come back with a new formula for application of that. The Congress plainly has not done that. And so under Shelby County, this major provision, actually two of them, 4 and 5 of the Voting Rights Act, were found unconstitutional and no longer a part of things that are accessible in the wake of the Shelby County decision and the freedom now from all of these restrictions by the Department of Justice. Many states then go off and begin to implement the very rules that probably otherwise would have been limited by and restricted by the Department of Justice. And that's where we began to get all of these lawsuits in recent years. Again, in particular, in the past 10 or so, 13 or so years in the wake of Shelby County. Go forward to 2021, another case called Brnovich versus Democratic National Committee. Brnovich, he is the attorney general at the time of the state of Arizona. In that case, a majority of the justices have found that Section 2, again, this core provision of the Voting Rights Act, again, limited in its capacity to remedy the ways in which we collect votes and assemble votes for counting. In particular, the Supreme Court held that a couple of packages of pieces of legislation that the Arizona had legislated that limited the ways in which principally the Native American Indian populations in Arizona could vote were in fact legitimate, that the legislature's decision to prohibit what's called harvesting of votes, meaning gathering of votes from very distant locations, principally on reservations throughout the state, people who could not otherwise get to particular voting spots to hand in their ballots individually. The practice had developed, as it has in other states, of individuals saying, we'll pick up legitimate ballots, we'll take them for you to the balloting spots, the clerk's offices, the places where those ballots are collected and tallied, and we will do that for you. the legislature finding that that is inappropriate and that there could be fraud in that. No indication that there was fraud, but nonetheless, their legislation is supported by the Supreme Court. There's also another piece of legislation that the Arizona legislature puts in place, and that says that if you happen to vote in the wrong precinct, the wrong place, and somehow that goes forward, your vote does not count. And again, between those two things and the fact that, again, many of the populations, Native American Indian populations and others in Arizona, are widely dispersed, the impact of Brnovich versus DNC is that there is legislation, now the law in Arizona, that markedly restricts the capacity of people in Arizona to vote and to get their ballots to places where they can be collected. So we've got Shelby versus Holder in 2013, Brnovich versus Democratic National Committee in 2021, and then we come up to Louisiana versus Calais, which again is just this term. Before we get there, there's one other element that I need to put into the mix, and that is a case called Rucho, R-U-C-H-O, versus Common Cause. It falls right in the middle of these cases, 2019. A 5-4 majority of the Supreme Court found that partisan gerrymandering, making determinations about line drawing, presents a political question that's beyond the jurisdiction of the federal courts, and therefore the federal courts cannot intervene, cannot stop, strike down voting districts that are drawn in favor of one political party or another. So what does that mean? It means that as of 2019 in this country, there's no prohibition on political parties, Republicans, Democrats, others, who may be in the power of legislatures to draw political lines based exclusively upon political determinations. I want Republicans to win, and so I'm going to draw lines based upon Republican areas of voting. I want Democrats to win, and therefore I do the same thing. And that decision, although it may seem unseemly to many of you, is legal in America. And it has been animating, of course, a lot of the gerrymandering that we have talked about on this broadcast that has been one of the singular issues of voting in America. That's Rucho versus Common Cause, that again, federal courts, the courts in America, will no longer get involved in political gerrymandering decisions. Now, keep that in mind as we think about what happens in Louisiana versus Calais. Well, beginning in 2022, a circuitous, a very, very odd and lengthy history of this case included the Louisiana legislature's vacillating because of court directives between having only one majority Black district in that state and two judicially ordered Black districts among six altogether in a state where about one-third of the population is Black. So among the six, you would very roughly anticipate that maybe about two of those six, about one-third of the congressional districts, might be majority Black districts. And again, the Louisiana legislature, the Louisiana authorities, based upon court directives, increased the number of majority Black districts from one to two. And that was followed by another lawsuit challenging even that action, and in particular, challenging the creation of these two districts, that one of them reaches from Shreveport in sort of the northwestern portion of the state all the way down to Baton Rouge, the capital, kind of in the south central portion, the boot of the state. That's District 6. And District 2 is along just below that. It reaches down to New Orleans, both of them creating this sort of serpentine district or set of them that goes throughout the state of Louisiana. What happens is, because of the nature of that redrawn map there, some folks come forward and say that violates the 15th Amendment, that violates the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, by making decisions premised upon race. The matter gets up to the United States Supreme Court. And again, this is the significant determination made by the Supreme Court in this major case involving the state of Louisiana, but involving all states of our nation as we understand what the Voting Rights Act of 1965 is all about. 6-3 vote. Again, right down party lines, partisan perspectives. The Supreme Court concludes that state legislators, the ones who had done this, creating the second majority Black district, had illegally used race in creating the new second majority Black district, and that's in violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, 14th Amendment of the Constitution. They said there's nothing about Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act that compels that, And that for that reason, the map that was created with those two majority black districts has to fall, maintaining that Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is still available in other circumstances. The majority at the pen of Associate Justice Sam Alito writes this. He says, vast social change, particularly in the South, presumably including Louisiana, including increased voter registration and turnout by racial minorities, all of those changes over the period of time since 1965 requires that the court update the 40-year framework for evaluating the use of race in drawing congressional districts. Basically, all but reading race out of considerations that can be done, can be pursued when these kinds of things are undertaken by legislators. Let me say that again. Vast social change, things that have changed in the country, prompts the Supreme Court to say that we're no longer going to compel the drawing of lines based upon racial considerations. Equal Protection Clause prohibits that. Section 2 does not require that. And therefore, the Louisiana maps have to fall. Now, what is the implication of that? Why, that's very, very wonky, if you will. It does require, again, an awful lot of analysis. And here that is. What it means now going forward is that to successfully overturn any district maps anywhere in the country, Louisiana and Wisconsin, other places where there may be challenges based upon gerrymandering, racial and yes, political as well, challengers now have to show some evidence, some clear evidence supporting a strong inference, a very clear inference that lawmakers, and here's the important word, intentionally drew lines, purposely drew lines to afford minorities less opportunity because of their race. And the justice went on to say, a lawsuit that cannot disentangle, separate out race from states' race-neutral considerations, including politics, that's a reference to Rucho, will fail. Now, what does all that mean once again? Well, it means just this, that if you've got a legislator who stands up and says, I'm going to redraw lines in my state, I'm going to do it for political reasons because I want my party, the people who are in my party with me, to be successful. I want to send them to Congress in greater numbers. We know under Rucho, the courts will no longer stop doing that. It used to be, before Louisiana-Calais, that the only limitation on that, the reason why Section 2 was so significant, is that if your political gerrymandering results and has the impact, the effect of disenfranchising people of color, those can still be challenged. And that's the remaining portion, or was the remaining portion, of the Voting Rights Act. What Calais does is it removes that notion from the analysis here. Does this new framework that says you no longer have to be concerned about the impact or the effect of your gerrymandering, including, of course, gerrymandering principally for political reasons. I can redraw my lines and I can simply say that is for political purposes. And if the impact, the effect of that happens to be that along the way, I also disenfranchise people of color, people of languages, not English, so be it. That is a consequence. That's an effect of what I'm doing. And Calais says the courts will no longer take a look at that. As long as there's not evidence, which is not going to be a part of these records, of express intent, very clear purpose. No one's going to stand up, of course, in America in 2026, hopefully not, and say, I'm doing this for the sole purpose of disenfranchising people of color. Instead, what they're going to do is to stand up and say, yes, I'm drawing lines as I can do for political purposes. And the fact that the drawing of lines for those partisan reasons results in people not being able to vote for folks in their particular districts who might be of their preference, that is a consequence that is no longer a part of the analysis. It is only if there is some indication of express intent, purposeful reason to go ahead and deny people the franchise, only there, which again, you're not going to find, only there can new lines be found unconstitutional. The practical effect of this, according to the dissenters, that includes Sonia Sotomayor and Ketanji Brown Jackson and Elena Kagan, is to make it nearly impossible, again, this is from the dissent, to use race when drawing up voting maps, setting back the foundational right that Congress granted, she's talking, of course, about the Voting Rights Act of 1965, of racial equality in electoral opportunity. Let me say that again. The practical effect of a decision is making it nearly, and you can almost eliminate the word nearly, impossible to use race in drawing up voting rights, voting maps to remedy past histories and setting back the foundational right that Congress had established in the Voting Rights Act back in 1965. The NAACP, Legal Defense Fund, describes this ruling as the worst case scenario for voting going forward. Again, turns back decades of our understanding about how race can and should be considered to ensure that all people have access to the polls. Louisiana Attorney General, who is defending the decision to get rid of these two majority black districts, she says this is a seismic decision affirming equal protection. And again, the debate goes forward. So Louisiana, the map there, of course, changes. And sure enough, within hours after that decision is made, the governor there, his name is Jeff Landry. He suspends primary voting in that state and says that he's going instead to have an open primary on November 3rd, at which time all candidates, regardless of their party, will compete on the ballot in their district. And absent an outright majority, there will be a two top vote getter vote on December 12th of this year, a runoff between those folks, changing dramatically what's going on in Louisiana. And in the wake of that, of course, Louisiana itself, the legislature gets to work and redraws a new map. And the 200-mile map in favor of one majority black district gets back in place. And the legislation, again, that adopts what the Supreme Court has said, that is, you do not need to have a second majority black district. That goes forward, the state Senate, the state House of Representatives. It's promptly signed by the governor. And significantly, the legislative lead on this is a fellow named Committee Chair Jay Morris. He embraces exactly what we've talked about. He says these maps are drawn to maximize Republican advantage for the incumbent Republicans that we have in Congress. And why is that statement important? Well, he's saying, I can do this. I can do that legally under Rucho. And there's nothing about his statement that comments or expresses at all a racial animus, a racial purpose. And for that reason, the lines that he's drawn, even if they do, in fact, and probably will, disenfranchise people in Louisiana of color, that is not the question. The impact of what they're doing is no longer relevant. On the other side, you've got Senator Sam Jenkins. He is speaking about the people opposed to this. He says Republicans are using partisanship as a cover for discriminatory purposes against a group of people, particularly black voters and Democrats, underlining once again, underscoring the impact of Calais in Louisiana. But it goes on, of course, and we know that within days after Calais, other states pick up the new freedom granted them by the Supreme Court under Calais, again, to draw lines basically without any rules. Do it according to your own political views and perspectives. Do not be concerned about the impact upon race in your particular state. Sure enough, the Tennessee legislature within days retargets the 9th congressional district and chops up the city of Memphis into three discrete districts and redistributes, or cracks in the word of the way in which gerrymandering is done, predominantly black populations there among all of the districts there, and effectively creates a complete delegation of Republican strongholds coming out of the state of Mississippi, and also disenfranchising by removing that one majority black district in and around the state of Mississippi. In the state of South Carolina, even though the governor called for a legislative session, in the end, the legislators there say, we're concerned about voter confusion, we're concerned about logistical hurdles, the immediacy of the upcoming primary elections, and widespread public opposition. The governor, his name is Henry McMaster, and the legislature then pull back on that, and they decide to work on this down the road. Does not happen in South Carolina, but it does happen in Alabama. And here the situation, a bit complicated by the fact that there was also an Alabama case pending before the Supreme Court. In the wake of Calais, the Supreme Court sends that one back to the state, and there Governor Kay Ivey signs a legislative measure that authorizes a special primary election on August 11th. For those congressional districts, the numbers of those are the 1st, the 2nd, the 6th, and the 7th, whose redrawn boundaries, again, in the wake of Calais, revert back to an earlier plan with only one majority black district. Again, the same kind of thing. We've got voting coming up there in the state of Alabama based upon this revised voting map in that state. And we know as well that in the state of Georgia, even though they too, like Alabama, have indicated we're not going to do it right now, but Brian Kemp in mid-June, he's the governor there, convened a special legislative session. And he was asking then that state lawmakers follow what Kelly directed and redraw the House maps for the upcoming election. In the end, he pulls back on that and says, let's wait until 2028. And he also says, however, that Kelly permits us to do this. House Speaker John Burns, interestingly, once again, underscores the problem with doing this at this time and right before primary and other elections. He says, we need to take our time to understand the full ramifications of how race can or cannot be used. And the speaker there encapsulates exactly the issue in Calais. The answer is that race no longer needs to be a concern when it comes to the impact. It's only if there is some express statement about racial purpose and intent, that's not going to happen. And for that reason, there in Georgia, one day in the near future, presumably for the 2028 maps, the legislators there can draw lines that have the impact of not considering racial voting in that state. And according to my own very, very rough analysis, there are 9 states, also including places like California and Florida and Missouri and North Carolina and Texas and Utah, that have also been or restyling their congressional maps to these diverse political ends. Democrats are doing it, and also Republicans are doing it. Other states have deferred action until after the current primary session. We know as well that even though it's not a product of the Kelly decision, we know what happened in Virginia. There, the Virginia Supreme Court struck down a decision by the voters in that state to create 4 Democratic-leaning House seats. And the challenge to the creation of those seats based upon a statewide referendum was that the process by which that was done was not proper. The High Court in Virginia, that is the Virginia Supreme Court, says that the Democratic legislators placed before the voters a constitutional amendment to allow these revised voting lines in an unprecedented manner that violates the state's constitution, irreparably undermining the integrity of the resulting referendum vote and rendering it null and void. What they're doing is they're challenging, of course, the ways in which the referendum was pursued, all sorts of things related to notice being having to posted by county clerks and the legislative session in which this was done, convened for budget, not voting reasons, all sorts of procedural things. When the Virginia Supreme Court strikes down those 4 Democratic seats, the Democrats there go to the federal Supreme Court. They seek an emergency application asking the Supreme Court in Washington to tell the Virginia Supreme Court to withdraw its opinion. The United States Supreme Court refuses to do that on its emergency docket, even though Virginia says this was depriving voters, their candidates, of their right to lawfully enacted congressional districts, as they've said in their referendum. And in May, the Supreme Court declines to overturn the Virginia ruling. In the wake of all this, the governor there, her name is Abigail Spanberger, confirms that the 2026 congressional elections in Virginia would be conducted under the current 2021 map, principally because, again, of all the machinations related to that referendum. But all of this, what is the point of all of this, is we are now doing redrawing of lines, whether it's in the wake of Calais, which again opens up the possibility in all places to doing this, again, based upon political views and political perspectives, without concerns about the impact upon race. That changes one of the central issues of our time, gerrymandering. We know that other states, presumably even after the primaries of 2026, may consider making similar changes in the not too distant future. They can do that now under Calais. It is the rule of the land. And they may also pursue other matters, as we've seen in Virginia. The impact of this, of course, is that we're now doing redistricting in a way that the Constitution did not contemplate. It doesn't prohibit this line drawing in mid-decade, but plainly the Constitution, the founding fathers envisioned that after the census, beginning every decade, that's the time that the legislators and governors and others would make determinations about the lines that are drawn. We have now opened up a system where now mid-decade, and frankly beyond the mid-decade, states around the country, not all of them, and not the state of Wisconsin and others, but many states can and will begin to redraw lines. Note as well that we're going to do all of this again in just about 3.5 years with the change in the calendar once again, the new decade, when 2030 comes around, a new census reports being given to the state legislators. And as a result of that, a whole new round in every state of the union, all the territories, redrawing lines once again, and doing so in a new jurisprudential way, in the wake of Calais that eliminates, again, Section 2 as a viable way of defending the focus on race in America. We know that also now that Calais, in the wake of Brnovich and Shelby County, the third strike by the Supreme Court against a landmark piece of legislation, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. That's the history that all but now brings the Voting Rights Act to its knees. You can still use Section 2 in some areas that would, say, challenge a particular voter or groups of voters, but gerrymandering now effectively permitted under the law, under Calais, and changing the ways in which we then broadcast of Amicus Law Review. Stay with us for all of those, and stay with us for our next broadcast, as we return to our current events analysis, the things going on in the areas of rule of law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. We'll be back every week with these broadcasts, with these podcasts, commenting on the news of our time. Until then, have a great week. Look at the news, analyze it, and know that we also will be joining you in our discovery of America in the areas of rule of law. Thanks for your attention. Thanks for joining me in this exploration together.